Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Chatting this morning with Lauren Wells, who is an educator at Dolan Middle School in Stamford. Lauren, thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Melissa?
I'm good. So what was your first reaction to the initial school plans, kids heading back in the fall for fully in-person classes?
It worries me. It worries me a lot.
It does.
Especially because if we need to keep kids, you know, distance and masked up, I don't know how that's going to work, especially keeping them at, you know, at a distance when they're sitting in class. Mm-hmm. Our classrooms are not, the physical classrooms are not huge, but the amount of students that are in each of our classes are big. You know, some of our science and social studies classes, the max is 30 and they are at 30.
Wow.
And, you know, you have like a science class, a friend of mine, her science class, she has tables in her classroom and she has like 6 or 7 tables and she has 4 or 5 kids at a table. Like, there's no way you're keeping them 6 feet or 3 feet or even a foot apart, let mm-hmm. alone 6 feet or 4 feet or whatever the new possible plans are going to be. And the hallways, when the bell rings, there's 600-700 kids in the hall.
It's like, mayhem
in the middle school.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine, like, at, you know, like Stamford High, where there's like almost 3,000 kids.
Wow.
Like, I just, like, things like that are what worry me. And mm-hmm. like middle schoolers, they have to, like, they want to hug each other and this and that. And like, we had problems before all of this keeping them from hugging each other.
Right.
They were like, guys, stop hugging, no hugging. They're like, why? We're like, because it's not appropriate for school.
Right. You know? Sure. Sure.
Like, now it's just not appropriate or safe.
Right. And the other thing that worries me, Lauren, that they can't, at least at this point, the commissioner can't really pinpoint, and I have no clue how teachers are supposed to do this accurately without getting distracted. How do you manage the option that families have, which is, well, I don't think I want to send my kid back. So what if you're looking at 3/4 of your classroom, they're there, but the other quarter mm-hmm. are at home? How do you possibly balance the two? How do you do that?
That's a really good question. I wish somebody would be able to tell us that. Like, when initially when they talked about having the kids on, you know, like an A-B schedule. So, mm-hmm. you know, group A goes Monday, Wednesday, Friday for week one, and group B goes Tuesday, Thursday, and then, you know, week two they flip. I thought that was actually a pretty good idea. You could have half the amount of kids in the building at a time. You could have set up, you know, some online independent work for the kids that are home on those 2 days. Where it could be supporting what you had taught them when they were in person. I thought that was actually feasible. Mm-hmm. But in terms of trying to manage both online teaching, because if those kids aren't coming to school, you now have to teach them something. You're not giving them independent work to support what you taught them in the classroom.
Right.
You have to now teach them from September. So at least when we were home in March, we were supporting what we had already done with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we had already established things. We had established, you know, norms and what we expected of them in terms of their work completion. And that was already there. We had a rapport with the kids. So they knew kind of you as a teacher and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But to start out with kids that may not come back to school, kids that we've never taught before, don't know their learning style or what they
need. I didn't
even
think of that.
On a day-to-day basis, I don't know how that's going to work. They're not going to trust us, because with teaching, it's all about trust.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't trust us and have a relationship with us, they're not going to work for us. And mm-hmm. I find that, especially in my role as a special educator, that my kids have to trust me because they're so vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
because they have to be able to be comfortable and say to me, Mrs. Walls, I don't understand. And for any kid, that's hard, especially a middle schooler who has learning difficulties to begin with.
I totally forgot that this is a new, right. I forgot that this mm-hmm. is a new class too. I didn't even think about that.
Yes.
Right.
That's the hardest part. Like, we're starting distance learning for extended school year coming up next week.
Mm-hmm.
And this will be, I'm glad that I'm doing it. I teach summer school every year, but I'm glad that I have the opportunity to start with a brand new group just for this. You know, it's 19 days, so it's not a ton of time. I'm not trying to really teach them anything new. I'm just trying to keep their skills where they are to help them maintain till they start back in school.
Sure.
So it'll be, it's a good kind of experiment for me to see how I start a new relationship with kids that I don't know over the computer, because I know that's one of the things that I pride myself on is building relationships with my students. And so this will be like a test for myself to see how I can do that virtually. And not necessarily then mess up the whole year with the
right.
students that I'm just meeting. So at least it's just, you know, we're together for 19 days. We're just kind of, you know, building and helping kind of maintain their skills.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been my big thought all along was with distance learning. It was, thank goodness I had relationships with my kids already.
Right, right. Now you don't, though. Right.
Right.
What are parents telling you guys? Like, what are you hearing from the parents?
I haven't really heard anything from the parents, especially because we're not in school right now.
Sure.
So I think we might have heard more if we were, you know, still in session.
Mm-hmm.
But not being in session, that's a little different. But I truly, like, and I've had this issue for a long time, where there's people that come up with rules and regulations for schools who have either never been in a classroom before or who haven't been in a classroom for a very long time. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, the governor and, you know, the school.
The commissioner. Yeah.
Thank you. A commissioner haven't been in some of these schools in a really long time. And
right.
some of these things might be able to be implemented in smaller school districts.
Mm-hmm.
Stanford's huge. Like, we have 12 elementary schools. We have 5 middle schools. You know, we have 3 main high schools. So it's like,
and
in those schools, they're huge.
Mm-hmm.
And our buildings are not super, you know,
spaced out.
Substantial. You know, they're old buildings, a mm-hmm. lot of them. And like my classroom, I have 2 tables, and my classroom isn't much bigger than, say, you know, somebody's, you know, good sized master bathroom,
mm-hmm.
you know. So to try to keep my kids at a distance, first of all, it's not feasible because they're at 2 tables,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I have sometimes 8 kids in a class. So, which doesn't seem like a lot, but if you saw the space that I have 8 kids in, you're going to say, oh my gosh, how are you going to do that?
Yeah, all of a sudden, you feel like you're in a closet almost. That's crazy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
gosh, yes.
Wow.
And then I worry about, you know, just the gen ed classes where they're larger, you know,
mm-hmm.
the science, social studies, the art, the music, the PE. I just don't know how that's going to work. Or the buses.
oh sure.
How are the kids on the bus?
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
What does that look like?
They're literally on top of each other. Like,
uh-huh.
we had one bus that came from, I don't remember which neighborhood it came from, but it was so big. There were so many kids that were on that bus route. They had to split it last year because there were kids that, you know, they didn't get a seat. You know,
Wow.
So I'm thinking now, I don't know how that's going to work. And then how you're going to then monitor keeping kids masks on.
In your professional opinion, you've been an educator for quite some time. Do you honestly believe middle schoolers, even elementary school kids, are going to wear a mask for 5-6 hours a day, even if there are breaks involved?
No. I don't think I could.
Right.
I go crazy when I'm, like, at a grocery store. You know, like yesterday I was at, you know, like I was doing some errands and I was at the grocery store and I was, you know, at Michael's and you just random places. And oh my goodness, I couldn't wait to get that thing off. And it's hot. So when we go back to school, it's going to be hot again. And my school in particular, we don't have air conditioning. Like, I don't know how that's going to work. Just like, even if we could keep the kids to keep their masks on, it's going to be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a long time to expect kids to keep a mask on.
Yeah.
So I know at least for myself, you know, I could take it off for at least 2 hours a day because I don't have kids during those 2 hours.
Sure.
But the kids are always with other kids.
Right.
You know, the only time that I think that, you know, they would be okay to take it off is when they're eating.
Right, lunch or recess, I would guess, because they're outside at least. But that's about it.
Right. And middle school, we don't even have recess.
Right, middle school has no recess. I just realized that. Right. So,
yep.
Wow.
But, like, I don't know. And then I don't know how you're going to, how you could expect a kindergartner to keep a mask on.
Right, right.
You know, so if you have a kindergartner, first experience in school, and now they have to keep a mask on, which I don't know how that's going to work.
Right.
Like, there's lots of pieces with this that I don't know. And I'm hoping that, you know, the governor is going to give school districts some autonomy with this.
It sounds like it's
kind of.
Yeah. I was going to say, it sounds like the commissioner is kind of leaning on districts to sort of shape what that's going to look like. And I'm wondering, Lauren, because in the beginning of our conversation, you were saying that there were ideas of doing like an A and B group, splitting up half the school to come on days of the A's and then, you know, B group 2 days a week or whatever the case may be. And they may say, hey, you know what, Stanford is a bigger school district and we're going to have to do something like that. I don't know, especially while you leave it open ended, saying that parents have a choice whether or not they want to send their kids to school. I've got to think that teachers need to know that by August, because you're now dealing with, do you need more teachers on staff? How do you get more teachers on staff with budgets? And
especially because we just cut 163 positions, I think, in Stanford. Not all of them were actual classroom teachers, but still.
Wow.
We just had to cut that many because we had a $12.5 million budget deficit.
Yep.
So trying to do that plus implement some of these things, I truly don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if we're expected to teach in classroom, I don't know how we then could teach as well online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the other piece where with that part, it's almost like you'd have to have, you know, like group the kids where, okay, these are the online kids and this teacher is going to have this group of online kids and not have a live class in place of that. Because like in middle school, we have four classes. So if I had one online class and three in-person classes, you know, maybe that could balance.
Sure.
But if I'm expected to teach four classes plus possibly have one or two or however many sections of online classes, that's now going over what our technically our
right, you got to sleep at some point.
Time is supposed to be.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because you can then don't have planning time. How are you going to now plan for two separate different platforms?
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot to try to do.
Mm-hmm.
Especially try to do it almost on the fly if we don't know in advance.
I do not envy teachers. Yeah.
It's kind of a repeat of what happened in March where it was like, okay, now you're online.
Right, right.
Okay, but at least everything was online.
Exactly. It was uniformity.
I think it's going to be harder to try to balance that. Okay, so these kids are always at home. These kids are always in the classroom. You know, and how do you try to manage that? And, you know, and you're not going to get as far in a lesson online as you are in person. Just the, you know, the sheer, are the kids understanding it? You know, technology issues, you're going to end up with less time with the kids, you
right.
know? So at least when the bell rings, they walk in, you start, you have your, maybe by the time they walk in 50 minutes. But by the time you get online and everybody, you know, how long can a kid sit at a computer?
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
Yeah.
You know, I know
yeah.
I start to go stir crazy.
Absolutely.
So it's definitely going to be a learning curve, but I feel like there needs to be, you know, some contingency plans if we find like this isn't working, or is there an uptick in our numbers? You know, I don't know. I don't know. There's so many unknowns, and I know it's hard for, you know, for everybody to plan that because there are so many unknowns.
Right. Because we could have a surge in August, you know, like we could be right back to where we were in March. I mean, knock on wood, that doesn't happen, but let's be real. We could see another resurgence. So, you know, this could all go out the window as far as August and we're right back to where we were in March. So,
They have been talking about, you know, there could be a resurge, you know,
in
coming
October,
again,
yeah,
you know, like in like flu season kind of thing.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know. And this is my 18th year, and obviously nothing like this has ever come up for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, when you're working with adults, it's a little bit easier because adults understand, and you know, they're obviously going to comply more than kids at some time.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know how it's going to pan out. And it worries me.
Yeah.
It does.
Well, Lauren, I hope to check in with you maybe later on this summer when things are a little bit clearer.
Absolutely.
I'd love to have you back on. It would be great.
anytime, Alyssa. You know that.
I appreciate you, Lauren. Thank you so much. And yeah, praying that we have a clearer picture. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you. Thanks, Lauren.
Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks, you too. Checking in right now with Krista Carnes, who is our social media consultant. Krista, how are you?
I'm well, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So, Krista, I was at a local shop yesterday, and the owner said to me as I was checking out, because she knows I work in news, she said that her kids a lot of times will rely on social media, specifically TikTok, which I'm not too, I don't use TikTok, but I know of it, to get their news headlines. In your professional opinion, how reliable is it that people are turning to social media for their top news?
I mean, in some ways, I think it's a great aggregator, right? I find a lot of, headlines that I read that interest me and I click through to the actual media source. I think what we have to do is be careful that the sources we are reading when we click through are reputable sources. So if everybody has an opinion on things, and when you share it on social media, you're obviously supporting it. And you can make some comments on it, but we really just want to be thoughtful about reading through what we're getting. I mean, because it's so easy for, non-news or inaccurate portrayal to be shared. So, I think TikTok, I think it's a lot of kids, younger people responding to what they're seeing out there. And in some ways, I think it's probably building up a lot of interest, it's generating more interest in current events and the social issues that they care about, as long as they're getting their news from actual news sources. In fact, I just read today that Yahoo News is the most, the most sought after platform for news.
Really?
So just be careful of that. Yeah, it was. And I think what we're going to talk about next is, political news too is even harder to parse out because it is so opinion based and you're really trying to influence other people's thoughts and feelings and figure out how you feel about issues. So being really looking around, checking more than one source, don't take everything at face value, but read multiple resources.
I think that might be one of the hardest things, even working in news, apart from social media. One of the biggest reasons that, quite frankly, I got out of television news is because it became too political. You start to sway one way or the other based on whatever the company ideals are or whatever your personal preference is, or even your audience driving what you want to talk about versus hard facts. What is the truth? And I think too often we are sort of dirtied is the right word by politics. And, and you bring up, this is a big election year. We're heading into a huge year, especially a presidential election year. How crucial would you say social media is to the election, let's just say?
Well, I think you have to. I mean, I think it's actually more critical than the campaign people are probably just freaking out right now.
Because, sure.
With the pandemic, really the only way we can reach people is through television. And many people are not watching television in the ways that they did 20 some odd years ago, with cutting the cords and all these, apps and streaming and things. So social media is a major part of that. And I think what we have to do as citizens is, realize when we're reading opinion and when we're reading facts. Mm-hmm. And, social media is all about opinion, and journalism in general has changed to become more about opinion and thought leaders. So they're not as I think they just don't feel as required to share the facts as much as they want to share their opinions. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It's who are they preaching to? I think a good, if you have some time on your hands, which I think we might have, take a look at one night, watch PBS News and then watch another network and watch a network you would never, ever watch, and read resource and sources that you might not ordinarily read, because the thing about social media is the algorithms are set to serve you up more or less stuff you already agree with. Mm-hmm. And to be truly informed, I think we have to look at what is being said, on the other side, what's the merits of that and the facts that are driving that. So being a very conscious consumer of media is a really wise tactic, because if we only listen to one song, that's all we're going to know. Mm-hmm. And I think there's too much at stake and there's too many things. And people are trying to get you, they're trying to influence your opinion. So forcing yourself to look around is going to give you some some more perspectives.
Talking to Krista Carnes, who's our social media consultant here on WICC 600. Now, what I do find has been good about social media is I think it's been a really great driving force for things like rallies or getting messages out there or being able to, I guess, put activism out there. In some ways, it has been very helpful in that sense.
I totally agree. I think it's giving people agency to make, you know, to put their opinion out there. I think it's more important, you know, we don't always have to be political, but if something matters to you, social media provides you a platform to share that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking a lot about having uncomfortable conversations and you know, facing things that we might not have faced in the past with regards to social justice and racial justice and things of that nature. Those are in the, but there's also voting rights and, you know, immigration reform. There's all these issues that are going to influence our decisions at the polls, but we want to like, we want to share. And the thoughts shared and then they level up to more influential people, the broader the reach can be. And that is, I think, what we all want is we want as many people's voices to matter in the election, and we need to get out the vote on all sides so that we really, truly, you know, end up participating in our process. And it's not just for president, it's for senator, and it's for your local, you know, your local elections too. So if we have some time now at home where we're looking at our devices all the more, you know, taking some steps to share what you believe, actually it's very empowering. And I think it gives us some agency where we might have gone to a rally or some sort of event in the past. We're not going to be able to do that. So trying to find those collective voices online can be helpful.
Krista Carnes, if anybody wants to connect or follow one of your social media platforms, where can they go?
You can find me on Twitter at Krista Carnes and or Krista at KristaCarnes.com is my email.
All right, Krista, thank you so much for your insight on
this.
Melissa, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk soon. Okay, bye.
As I mentioned before the break, we've been really focused, obviously, on the pandemic and understandably so. But, you know, there have been a lot of big things happening overseas to keep our world healthy, cleaner, and just make it a better place. Keep Ghana Beautiful is actually the first African community improvement nonprofit to pair with Keep America Beautiful right here in the U.S. And joining me this morning, I'm excited to talk to CEO Helen Lohman, who is with Keep America Beautiful. So, Helen, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I think this is a really neat topic, and I love getting the insight from you guys. So, how many international affiliates do you guys actually have?
Well, we actually have six.
Wow.
We have two in the Bahamas, we have Bermuda, and then we have a couple in Canada as well. And now with Keep Ghana Beautiful, that'll be seven.
So how do you actually go about making an international affiliate like this?
Well, you know, it's actually very similar to our domestic local affiliates. You know, our program structures and our training are pretty much, you know, universally implemented. You know, they rely on building a grassroots community model, using local resources, infrastructure, policy and building partnerships down at the grassroots level so that they can all work together to really determine what's best for their own community.
Would you say that's one of the biggest ways you assist these affiliates is kind of making that model for them? If they see what you guys are doing here in the States, maybe they can translate that in their own countries.
Yeah, we hope so. I mean, we feel like it's a model that's applicable anywhere. And, you know, we call it our model for change. And that allows them to really address the issues in their own communities that are important for them and that need to be addressed the most.
So give us a little bit of an idea. How did Keep Ghana Beautiful even come across your radar?
That's a great question. So we partnered with an organization called Atlas Corps. And the executive director of Keep Ghana Beautiful, whose name is Elijah Mensah, was an Atlas Corps fellow. And what Atlas Corps does is they bring emerging nonprofit leaders from all across the world here to the U.S. to work with nonprofits to increase their skills and to learn best practices here in the United States. And Elijah was our Atlas Corps fellow, and he came here and worked in our offices for a year. And he just returned to Ghana last week to see his family for the first time in a year.
Wow.
And that's where he'll be working to build, keep Ghana beautiful, and, to get funding for the team that works with him at Keep Ghana Beautiful.
How long has that been around?
Well, Keep Ghana Beautiful actually has been around sort of since 2014.
Okay.
Elijah helped to co-found an organization called Help Change Ghana. And that organization launched a community litter program, so a program to prevent litter. And he's trained volunteers. So it was very similar to the Keep America Beautiful model.
Mm.
And he took that and implemented it in his country. And then when he came here, he adapted it and improved it to become Keep Ghana Beautiful.
Speaking this morning with Helen Lohman, who's the CEO of Keep America Beautiful. Now, what are some of the needs in Ghana? You know, what is the mission of even having Keep Ghana Beautiful?
So, great question. You know, it's very similar to our own mission here. They have challenges with litter, the same as we do here. Issues around recycling, how to put recycling in place. You know, similar to here. Things with pollution and litter in waterways.
Mm-hmm.
They want to improve that. Planting trees and overall community pride and beautification of their communities. These are all things that are challenges in Ghana, just the same as they are here.
And I know that just from my church and some of the missions that they go on, I believe latrines are an issue too. There's a lack of those as well. So I know that sometimes can also lead to some, I wouldn't say beautification, but, like you said, pollution issues as well, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, latrines are a challenge in many African nations.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's not something that we necessarily work on, but there are a lot of organizations out there that build latrines, and that is definitely tied in many ways to the work we do.
Mm-hmm. And, Helen, the last time I think I spoke with you was right in the beginning of the pandemic. And
it certainly was.
Yeah. And I remember specifically we were talking about gloves and masks and things that were disposable being just tossed on the sides of roads and bushes and so forth. And I remember when you came on talking about, look, I hate to say it, but you can't just be picking up people's trash. We don't know about getting the virus and so on. Now, fast forward to where we are today. Are we still seeing that issue, and what's your advice to people?
We definitely are still seeing the issue of, what's now known as PPE litter, which is the litter of masks and gloves and wipes and any kind of waste that's tied to the pandemic. And I was this past weekend at the grocery store and saw the gloves and saw the masks in the parking lot. So at this point, we've spent a good deal of time trying to develop guidance to keep people safe if they are going to go pick up litter, and which we appreciate. And so, yes, we do have volunteers that are back out picking up litter. We have announced that we will move forward with our Great American Cleanup this summer. So that's going on now, and it will end in mid-October. And the Great American Cleanup is really when our, millions of volunteers get out, pick up litter, improve their communities. We are doing that. We have some really kind of very important and serious guidance on how volunteers need to stay safe while they're doing that work.
Sure. What is your website? I'd imagine that's where some of those resources are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kab.org.
Simple as that. Keep America Beautiful, kab.org. Well, Helen Lohman, always a pleasure to check in with you, and I hope to talk to you again really soon.
I hope so, too. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too, Helen. I appreciate it.